Well, I'm Di Donovan. At the time of the events portrayed in the film Pride, I was part of a minor support group in South Wales. I was taking part in the National Union of Mine Workers strike that took place in 1984-85. I was a very proud participant in that strike. Perhaps more importantly, with hindsight, 30 years hindsight, and the changes in law affecting gay and lesbian people in the UK, I'm even prouder of the role I played in meeting colleagues from the gay and lesbian community in London at that time.
Aww. Thank you, Doug. My name's Mike Jackson. Me and a friend founded a support group for the striking miners in the 1980s. And what was unusual about that, it was a lesbian and gay support group for striking workers, which I don't think had ever happened before on that kind of overt scale like that. And, well, the rest of the story is told in the movie Pride. There were only about 10 or 15 of us who were really core activists. And so these are the two gentlemen. We'll introduce themselves. And they were also core activists in the group.
My name's Dave Lewis. I was one of the people that was involved in the group from about 6 weeks in, collecting money. One of the most important political fights of my life, I think, really, and I can say that 30 years on.
I'm Martin Goodsell. I'm also one of the original members. I was there from the beginning, and I was politically active at the time. But the Lesbians Gay Support the Miners group was probably, for me, the most important political activity that I've participated in because of the repercussions of the miners' strike and the support from the lesbian and gay community at the time.
There were two worlds that were meeting each other there. There were the mine strikes and there were the struggle for the LGBT rights in the 80s in the UK. But could you explain maybe first what was it like to be gay in the 70s, 80s in the UK?
Well, I came out in 1973, which is about 2 to 3 years after gay liberation came to Britain. It all kicked off in the Stonewall Inn, a working class gay bar in New York in 1969, where there were the famous Stonewall riots. So I came out about 3 years after that, and I clearly remember those first marches that we used to have were obviously very small, but very, very political, very kind of militant. Of course, you know, being part of the LGBT community, there were always drag queens on things like that. So there's always an element of fun, but with a political message. And I saw really over the years that change and simultaneously become more and more depoliticised and more commercial and admittedly much, much bigger. You know, we've had Pride marches where there's been 50, 100,000 people present. But over time, what's very disappointing for me is how it's become depoliticised. Yeah.
Politically, the 70s and 80s were not a good time to be gay or lesbian in Britain, I think. I came out in 1980 and I had no fear, really. I didn't really care what the government thought. Although we were being told that being gay was an aberration and something that society didn't like, it didn't really touch me hugely.
Yeah, I grew up in London and I think I was probably quite lucky in where I grew up. I grew up very close to Earls Court, which at the time was the centre of gay life in London. That's where the clubs and pubs were. And even when I was still at school, probably about 16, I used to go with friends to gay bars in Earls Court. And when I became more political, I was actually selling socialist newspapers in some of the gay bars, which was quite a strange and unusual thing to be doing at the time. But I think also culturally in the UK at the time, with industrial unrest, with the development of the music scene, particularly punk, there were gay elements to the music scene. So culturally, I think it was easier. People were more androgynous in the way that they dressed. And I think amongst young people, there was far more acceptance and the beginning of people starting to come out and be and others being more accepting of gay people.
What was it like for you?
Well, it was quite unusual because I didn't knowingly know anybody that was gay. So I was sitting in the middle of a coal field where your daily concerns were going to work, doing the shift, coming home and taking time with the family. But I got to admit that at the time, consistent with the right-wing Thatcherite government, we had a newspaper called The Sun. And this newspaper would start to talk about gay people in a very pejorative way. And I must admit, I used to think, what on earth must it be like if you were gay and you were exposed to this national newspaper saying these things about you? But I think for me, it was as important because I had two young children at the time, young boy and a young girl. And I started to think, well, what if they were gay? How would I feel about that? So unknowingly, and I didn't know, hadn't knowingly met anybody that was gay up until that time, but I'd begun to feel about what was it like to be living in an area that was even more hostile. Well, frankly, it was hostile because at that time, prior to the 84-85 strike, the earlier strikes had touched me only less than the 84-85, so therefore it was a normal world. It was a world in which you went to work. But you were becoming exposed to the worst, the insidious nature of the Thatcherite right-wing press.
So you were all unified by Thatcher?
Absolutely, absolutely. Just to give you a bit more historical background as well, in the late 1970s, 1977 I think it was, there was a woman who was a kind of right-wing Christian called Mary Whitehouse. Mm-hmm. And there was our one and only gay newspaper, I think, at the time, called Gay News, an excellent little newspaper. And they published a poem called The Love That Dare Not Speak Its Name by Professor James Kirkup, who was, I think he was American. And she took out a prosecution against Gay News for invoking the blasphemy laws from the 19th century, and she won. So actually our newspaper was closed down. There's a huge campaign trying to fight against that. Our gay bookshop in central London called Gay's a Word, which features heavily in the movie Pride, that was also under attack. The Customs and Excise raided their premises on the pretext that they were stocking obscene material. Now, this is a bookshop, it's not a porn store. So it had things like, you know, the poems of Walt Whitman and Christopher Isherwood and things like that. But nevertheless, the state went in there and confiscated their goods. You had the issue of what we called pretty policemen. This was completely illegal for the British state to do it, but nevertheless they did. They would get good-looking young policemen to go out wearing tight denim jeans and denim jackets and hang it around to try and actually effectively importune gay men. And then when those gay men fell victim, they would pounce on them and say, you're under arrest. Now, that's agent provocateur, which was completely illegal. So, we were encountering kind of vilification in the media. The state was attacking us. The police were attacking us. Lesbians were losing custody of their children simply because they had the temerity to come out as lesbian. So we were under attack from quite a lot of different kind of fields. At that stage, of course, AIDS hadn't its ugly head hadn't written. So I think that's in a sense why, you know, those of us who were political, we could make connections.
Did the mine strike catches you as a moment when, you know, you don't care anymore, you just stand against it?
Oh, it was a clarion call. Margaret Thatcher came into power in 1979, and I just remember watching her speech out on the steps of 10 Downing Street when she recited
St. Francis of Assisi,
that was it, and just thinking, my God, what have the British people done? This woman, this is outrageous.
This is the, like, where there is discord.
I will bring harmony. It's like you think, what? And so she was popularity started to wane. So she picked a war with Argentina over the Malvinas Islands, the Falkland Islands. And of course, there's nothing like jingoism to actually raise your popularity in hustings. And so when the next election came, she got in again. That was 1982. And a year later, she provoked this fight with the coal miners. And so people like ourselves, I think I speak for all three of us here, just went, yes! Because we knew the miners would put up a big fight. Yeah.
Now, this was in effect, you know, the reaction of Thatcher against these strikes was a reaction against the very successful strikes of the 1970s against the Heath government, for which effectively a script was laid down, like, this is the way you have to...
Just called the Ridley Plan, isn't it, really? Yeah. And it was a direct result of the defeats imposed on the Conservative government, on the Edward Heath government by the miners, and then an earlier strike where there was no election, but the miners were given everything that they wanted. I think the issue, though, was that Thatcher came in with an absolutely different agenda, that what we term in the United Kingdom, that post-war consensus of a little bit for all, was against what Thatcher wanted to introduce. She wanted a Thatcherite, you know, the marketplace would rule. And I think that if you have a look at the anti-trades union laws that were in front, I believe, of the miners' strike, Tebbit's laws, which were taking away the ability of trades unions to act independently, were restricting the way in which trades unions could act. All all the ingredients were there, that most working people knew that there was a big battle coming. And if you were a Conservative, if you were a Thatcherite, you knew you had to take on the unions. You had to demolish the unions. They had to lose the faith in the unions of the working people. And I think it's fair to say that the National Union of Mine Workers was amongst those top unions, if not the prime union, where people had seen that one trades union could act unified and in solidarity. And so therefore the trades unions for the Thatcher government became the icon, if you like, and became the means by which they would denigrate trades union membership, and thereby they would put off other people for thinking that they could fight the British government when he wanted to introduce the Thatcherite government, when he wanted to introduce anti-working trades union laws.
Now, just for the benefits of our listeners, the miners at that time were operating at what was called a closed shop. Could you explain what that means?
Well, yes, a closed shop has fallen into disrepair, but in effect, if you wanted to work as a miner in the United Kingdom, you had to be a member of the National Union of Mine Workers. I don't think that's so strange, because I think there is a dislocation between what some people consider it is to be a member of a trades union and what it's actually like to be a member of the National Union of Mine Workers. The history of the 19th century and the earlier 20th century was of huge pit disasters with hundreds of men and boys losing their lives. So the only defence that the miners had was to form themselves into an effective and strong trades union movement. And there was no choice about it. You came to the colliery on your first day, and before you were given your lamp check, you were given the form for the national... Frankly, I don't think I even had a form. You were told you were a member. This is your membership number of the National Union of Mine Workers. It was very, very strongly instilled. But the communities as well were imbued in that. In South Wales in particular, the local doctor, the library, the education system was thanks to the National Union of Mine Workers. So the National Union of Mine Workers, whereas it represented workers, it had a very much broader agenda. It was about society and social justice, and it was about communities and looking after your own community.
And of course these mines were all in the national property. They were not...
They were owned by the state for the miners. The miners owned the industry. It was the same as the nationalist industries in the United Kingdom. So therefore, we were instrumental in producing the wealth for the country. They were our colonies. And I don't think that's anything that the police ever understood, that they could stand and guard the pit gates, but those galleries underground were ours. We never saw a policeman underground whenever you went underground. So therefore, the ownership of those mines was ours. And that's something neither the politicians or the police could ever understand.
Now, you have these communities on one side, very organised people, and then there's your movement. which is just coming to flourish and is kind of like at first pushed out of the community. How did that come together then?
I mean, there were links. I mean, for example, I grew up in my youth in a town in Lancashire near Manchester. Mm-hmm. And there was a coal mine there, and there was lots of heavy industry there. There were textile mills, there was machinery manufacturing, chemicals, you name it. So, you know, in some senses, it was part of my kind of background, really. And my grandmother, who was born in 1899, remembers women getting the suffrage, because she was in the late 20s before women were allowed to vote. So as a working class woman, she reminded me very much of the Women Against Pit Closures, people like Hefina, played by Melda in that movie. A very tough, strong working class woman who always impressed on us it was important to vote. She hated the Tories. She told me stories like in the 1920s and 30s, when television really hadn't been invented, or if it was, it was only privileged and rich, and even radios were expensive for people. So the only way they'd find out that who'd won a general election was that they'd walk to the town centre, to the town hall, and she told me that if the Tories got in, people would sit down and weep because they knew they were going to get a battering. And nearly 100 years later, we're back there again. Mm-hmm. We've got the number of homeless people I see on the streets in London is appalling. We never used to have this, not when I was a child.
Isn't there anybody else who wants to pick in? Because
yeah, I think we should also recognise that with the emergence of the gay movement after Stonewall in America, there were elements within the Gay Liberation Front and gay and lesbian people who were active in their trade unions that were out and did actually support... Mm-hmm. industrial struggles, the trade unions. So the seeds were already there. Yeah. And there was a previous strike. I can't remember the year, but I know that some people were involved, some gay groups. In Lancaster, wasn't it? Mm. So in Lancaster, there were individuals who were in the Gay Liberation Front who were supporting that strike. So there was a precedent, a small precedent, but I think lots of people in the gay movement, not everybody, but there were people that were class conscious, if you like, that actually engaged in their trade unions. They would try to develop support for gay rights within their trade unions, particularly, I think, amongst the teachers, particularly. Mm.
In the movie, we see the example of the town of Unwell. I always have problems with towns in Wales, I'll have to admit.
Shame on you. Unfly.
Silly Wales. No, but we see this particular town in Pride.
Yeah.
That's how much more towns like Unwell were there in the 80s.
Well, there were many because, interestingly, Onslow in there, which is portrayed in the film, it sat in the centre of six collieries around it in the beginning of the 20th century, and now it sits there with no collieries, no heavy industry around it at all. I think there, when you look at the coal industry, you can divide it into different parts of the United Kingdom, but also in South Wales, the east of the coalfield, which is the Rhondda Valley, that was primarily steam coal, and that led to the development of the identity of Welsh coal around the world. Everybody, I think, had heard of the steam coal and had heard of the South Wales coalfield, certainly. But we in the West mined anthracite coal, which was a richer vein of coal, and places like Onslow simply existed for one purpose alone, to mine that coal. And there were a number of communities which weren't in that concentration of the Rhondda Valley around the southwest area of the coalfield, just like Onslow, for whom their only purpose was to mine that coal. And so therefore you could see very clearly that if that coal ended, if the mining of that coal ended, what happened to that community? And so therefore it was no more, it was exemplarily stark, if you like, for our communities and the communities like Onslow and those around it for the cost of failure in battling Thatcher.
That one of the first times we went to, well, the very first time we went to Wales, I was quite shocked because I was expecting to see your area die, mm-hmm. like my area from childhood. Mm. And what I saw was this beautiful landscape, you know, ancient woodlands, lovely valleys and hills, and sheep everywhere. And then occasionally a pit. So it was so different to what I'd been accustomed to. And I could immediately think, good God, the only industry here is coal mining and sheep farming. And I've just discovered recently that often the South Wales coal miners had sheep as well. And the mine owners would have a real problem on when it came to the lambing season, because a lot of the miners would go absent from the mine because they had to look after their sheep. And that was because they were paid such poor wages. The sheep farming just kind of helped them to augment the wages. Yeah. So you could see if these mines were closed, it would be absolutely devastating. It's not only the miners and the mining families that would be devastated, but all the ancillary shops and pubs and so forth.
Yeah. It's a shame, really, because the Thatcher government was saying that this was a useless strike and it was a senseless strike because nobody had a job for life. What they never said, of course, was that coal mines did close. They closed through exhaustion. But what Thatcher was going to introduce for the first time ever was simply a blanket closure of 70 collieries throughout the United Kingdom, 20,000 men to go to the Dáil immediately. So far from the National Union of Mine Workers and the coalfield communities being senseless, it was the government that was senseless, because instead of considering a plan for coal, a plan for energy for the United Kingdom, they just had an agenda to break the National Union of Mine Workers. That's my opinion.